Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Stephen Mitchell's translation of and commentary on the second book of the Tao is a delight. Consider this gem. When a pickpocket sees a saint, he sees only his pockets. When a saint sees a pickpocket, he sees only his innocence. Tonight, we can take a break from our aggravation with AIG. See, I put it out there. Now you can just let it go. Our constantly erupted realities, our job worries, and focus on Stephen Mitchell's wise and witty second book of the Tao. Drawn from the work of Lao Tzu's disciple, Chuang Tzu, and Confucius's grandson, Su Tzu, which I'm probably mispronouncing, the second book of the Tao is, in Mitchell's words, both a companion volume and an anti-manual to the Tao Te Ching. Stephen Mitchell is a translator, poet, and novelist, educated at Amherst, the Sorbonne, and Yale, and, as he puts it, de-educated through intensive Zen practice. His many books include the best-selling Tao Te Ching, The Gospel According to Jesus, the Bhagavad Gita, the Book of Job, the Book of Gilgamesh, and Meetings with the Archangel. In conversation with Stephen tonight is Jack Miles, Distinguished Professor of English and Religious Studies at UC Irvine. Jack's writing has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, LA Times, and the Boston Globe. His book, God, a Biography, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1996 and has been translated into 16 languages. And we have both Jack's book and Stephen's new book for sale in the lobby tonight. If you purchase them here, the proceeds benefit the Los Angeles Public Library and Allowed. And both authors will be signing afterwards. A sequel to that book entitled Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God was published simultaneously in 2001 in the U.S., Britain, Germany, and France, and he is the general editor of the forthcoming, date-to-be-determined, Norton Anthology of World Religions. And I must note, he was last seen on the stage as a nimble matador with the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. Quite a memorable evening. Please welcome Stephen Mitchell and Jack Miles. Thank you.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to join you this evening, and a pleasure to share the stage with a friend with whom I'm having a reunion tonight after many years of not seeing each other, Stephen Mitchell. Stephen's new book is our subject for discussion this evening, and it is a translation, but it's a translation of a special sort. It's what I call a jazz translation. And let me offer a musical example to make that point clear. Most of us have probably seen The Sound of Music at some point. And in The Sound of Music, you hear Julie Andrews playing Maria sing the song My Favorite Things. Buoyant, smiling, wistful, perhaps just a touch, just enough. The Sound of Music is thought of as Rodgers and Hammerstein's worst musical, an all-time low for Hammerstein. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. Not great poetry, perhaps. And yet that song touched something in Barbara Streisand, who made a recording of My Favorite Things that completely transformed the song by taking all kinds of unforgivable liberties with it, some might have said, and created a new work of art that still in some way can be considered a homage to the original Rodgers music and Hammerstein lyrics. And sometime, was it before or after? I'd have to check the chronology. Another musician, John Coltrane, made another rendition, version, interpretation. We often hear the jazz interpretations of fill in the blank of my favorite things. And the liberty that Coltrane took was dispensing with the lyrics altogether. And yet they all three were somehow the continuation of the tradition, we might say, that was begun by Rodgers. Translations of ancient spiritual classics present a challenge of that sort. The writer who takes on the challenge, the risk of attempting to present ideas that are quite unlike those that might be dominant in our culture, written in a language, an idiom that's unfamiliar to us, has to take liberties of that sort. And Stephen has done that, as you know, with many spiritual classics from various traditions. The book that we're looking at this evening is called The Second Book of Tao. And as he says in his introduction, a first reaction that people who know something about Taoism might say is, what second book of Tao? There is a Tao Te Ching. Is there a second version of the Tao Te Ching? Well, not exactly, but the tradition that began with the Tao Te Ching and under Lao Tzu did continue. Lao Tzu and Confucius are the two wellsprings of religion, indigenous religion in China. In the 6th century, the 500s BCE, and they both attracted followers, and their followers sometimes wrote. One Confucianist was Confucius's own grandson, Tzu Su, and works of his were collected in various kinds of collection and handed down along with those of Confucius. After Lao Tzu, there came another master called Chuang Tzu, and he also had his sayings collected, anthologized, re-anthologized, and sometime between 300 and 100 BCE, there was a double anthology or there were two separate anthologies of these works. And it is from those that Stephen Mitchell has made a selection, creating the second Tao. In the Norton Anthology of World Religions that I'm editing, we have confronted ourselves the fact that the further back you go, the more mingled Confucianism and Taoism become. So it's not really taking all that great a liberty to mix them. And then there comes the question of how many of them you should choose. I have to quote this line, Stephen. Where is it?
It's at the end of the, note about the...
About the translation. Oh, yes. How many of these sayings or little incidents should he include? I settled on 64, he said. In this way, the number wasn't altogether arbitrary. While 81, the original choice, has a particular elegance to it, so does 64. Besides its arcane mathematical properties, it is the number of hexagrams in the I Ching, the number of squares on a chessboard, the number of sexual positions in the Kama Sutra, and the only two-digit number ever to star in a Beatles song. So, without further prelude, what I would like us... to do at this point is to turn to some of the actual selections in the book, and Stephen and I have agreed that that I will read his translation, and then he will read his commentary. Commentary, as you know, in these works of this sort, often completely overwhelms, drowns, crushes, obliterates the original. Not here. The translation on the left-hand page and the commentary on the right-hand page are equal in weight, and that in itself gives the book a certain lightness, a certain buoyancy. Having read it all now, I can say quite honestly it's a pleasure to read. So let's go to, we were discussing in what order we would proceed. Let me find my notes. Here we go. First, we're going to read a famous one about a butterfly and a dream. Chuang Tzu dreamt that he was a butterfly, fluttering here and there, carefree, unaware of a Chuang Tzu. Then he woke up, and there he was again, Chuang Tzu, beyond a doubt. But was he Chuang Tzu who had dreamt that he was a butterfly? Or a butterfly now dreaming that he was Chuang Tzu? There must be some difference between Chuang Tzu and a butterfly. This is called the transformation of things.
Here's the commentary. The most famous dream in human history. You may feel that, as with Zeno's paradoxes, there is something specious going on here if only you could put your finger on it. But the more closely you examine the story, the more penetrating Chuang Tzu's question becomes. He's the anti-serpent in the garden, tempting you to take one little bite from the tree of life. He's Alice's caterpillar, puffing on his hookah and asking, "Who are you?" In fact, with time running backward as in a Feynman diagram, Alice's caterpillar could well have metamorphosed into Chuang Tzu's butterfly, just to prove a point. You may be recalling that psyche, the Greek word for soul, can also mean butterfly. But let's leave the Greeks out of this. Chuang Tzu is definitely Chinese, he thinks. His butterfly is not a metamorphosis, not a metaphor. It's just a butterfly. Just? How can we know what depths of joy lie hidden within that pinpoint of a brain? The whole world contained in a garden, in a single flower, all time contained in a summer's day, and life one all-embracing multi-orgasmic fragrance. And who knows what a butterfly might dream of an ancient Chinese philosopher, perhaps, or of a 19th century Oxford don who was enchanted by little girls. This particular butterfly woke up as Chuang Tzu, or was it Chuang Tzu who woke up as himself? There he was again, beyond a doubt. Beyond a doubt? Ha! Things change before our very eyes, whether our eyes are open or shut. A butterfly becomes a man becomes a question mark becomes a winged creature, carefree, doing whatever it likes. Thus, identity melts away, and we are left with something more valuable, a self, a non-self that includes it all.
Not to interrupt with more commentary than that, I wanted to insert my own little Taoist saying of the evening, which is that the Tao is not Chinese. You won't find that saying anywhere in the Tao, but it struck me as quintessentially Tao to say it, so I insert it.
And wonderful. I love that because, you know, it seems to me that the whole interest of this book is that it's not about Chinese religion or religion at all. It's about a way to live our lives in a very clear and very kind way. So that's what it is to me, anyway. It's not an exercise in scholarship or a museum piece. It's the most important pointer towards a life of great depth and joy.
From butterflies, we turn now to fish, a related one, at least in my simple-minded way of seeing these things. This is number 38. Chuang Tzu and Hui Tzu were walking across the bridge over the river Hao. Chuang Tzu said, "Look at the minnows swimming and leaping to their heart's content. That's what makes fish happy." Hui Tzu said, "You're not a fish. So how do you know what makes fish happy?" Chuang Tzu said, "You're not me, so how do you know that I don't know what makes fish happy?" Hui Tzu said, True. I'm not you, so I certainly have no idea what you know. On the other hand, you're certainly not a fish. And that just proves that you can't know what makes fish happy. Chuang Tzu said, "Let's go back to your original question. You said, how do you know what makes fish happy? So when you asked that question, you knew that I knew it. I know it by standing here over the River Hao."
That's such a killer last line. How can you argue with that? Here's the commentary. Chuang Tzu and Hui Tzu, old pals and sparring partners, are at it again. That refers to a previous chapter where they have another wonderful discussion. Crossing the river, Hui Tzu stirs things up from a less than radical not knowing. Logically, he has the better case. But the conversation isn't about knowing. Chuang Tzu would be the first to concede that he can't know anything. The real topic is freedom. If what you hear is two men arguing about who's right, you've missed the point. An apocryphal sage named Einstein, who could easily have been photographed in an ebullient mood with his tongue out, said, "There is only one important question. Is the universe friendly?" Here's another way of putting it. When the mind is happy, the universe is happy. Does the universe seem unfriendly or neutral? It's only because you're seeing it that way. As Chuang Tzu watches the minnows swimming and leaping, his heart leaps too. Naturally, he projects his own joy onto them. He's happy for them, as them. And who's to say that this is not an accurate view of reality? For all we know, the whole universe is alive and pulsing with joy, joy pulsing from every minnow, every molecule, from every creature on earth, from fire, hail, snow and frost, mountains and barren hills, fruit trees and cedar forests, wild animals and tame, reptiles, insects and birds, joy to the world, all the boys and girls, joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea, joy to you and me.
Not going to the question of suffering in the next selection, but it occurs to me to insert an exchange that took place between John Cage and someone in the discussion audience that followed one of his performances. The questioner asked, "Mr. Cage, do you think there is too much suffering in the world?" And Cage's reply was, "No, I think there is just the right amount." Let's look at number 15. 15. The ancient masters slept without dreaming and woke up without concerns. Their food was spare and simple. Their breath went deep. They didn't hold on to life, and they faced death free of concepts, emerging without desire, going back without resistance. They never forgot their beginning. They didn't trouble their minds searching for what their end was. They received life as a gift and handed it back gratefully. Minds supple, faces serene. In a crisis, cool as autumn. In relationships, warm as spring. They were balanced throughout the four seasons and in harmony with the Tao. There was no limit to their freedom.
This is one of the first chapters that I fell in love with when I discovered Chuang Tzu as a very young and unripe Zen student. And it's a beautiful chapter, and it happens to be extremely accurate, too. When he says the ancient masters, he's talking about you. This is the commentary. The ancient masters had pared themselves down to the essential. They woke up, they ate, they worked, they made love, they raised their families, all the while unseduced by any thoughts that arose. This gave their lives a sense of spaciousness. They always had enough time to do what wanted to be done. They moved through each day as alert and unhurried as animals in the wild. How could they forget their beginning? That's where they were constantly centered in the moment before a thought. They had returned to the primordial, mind hovering over its own abyss, objectless, serene. No wonder their nights were dreamless and their skies full of stars. Gratitude makes no distinctions. It precedes its occasion. It is the magic well that never runs dry, the still waters where you kneel and see your own face, more beautiful than you could have imagined.
I have to say, Stephen, that the translation of this one is really, I think, my favorite in the book, for language. Really.
Thank you. I like it too.
Their breath went deep. That's just I like that. Beautiful. Okay. This next one is sort of risky in its way, I think. It's number 40. I guess I don't want to say what I think the risk is, but I will.
I'd be so interested if you do.
I will before we're done.
Good.
Are you worried about the world? Do you think it needs your guidance? Don't the heavens churn by themselves? Don't sun and moon find their places? What masterminds all this? What creates all the connections? What, without any effort, makes everything happen in its time? Is there some hidden mechanism that makes life be as it is? Do things just happen to turn out exactly the way they do? Do clouds make rain? Or is it rain that makes up the clouds? What force puffs them and punctures them? The winds rise in the north. They blow now west, now east, and wander across the heavens. What, without any effort, stirs up this unfathomable joy?
The first two lines there are my inventions, and some of this is extremely free and not at all translation, and sometimes barely adaptation even. As Jack said, more like a jazz improvisation sometimes. Here's the commentary. Some people have an Atlas complex. They carry the world on their shoulders. They believe that if they put the world down, it couldn't carry on by itself. Worry and fear, they think, are the motivators for right action. If they saw the world as perfect, they think, they would be complacent and passive. They would just stay at home and cultivate their own gardens. But what if cultivating your own garden were the best way to help the world? What if your little backyard could, with the proper care, grow enough vegetables and fruits to feed 1 million people? What if your gardening inspired 1,000 of your neighbors to do the same? Someone says, but a backyard can't feed 1 million people. Ah, my dear fellow, it's a metaphor. I'm not talking about physical food or even necessarily physical people. Worrying about the world is a dead end. When nuclear proliferation is solved, global warming pops up. When global warming is solved, overpopulation starts looming. Then there's always the burning out of the sun and the infinite expansion or contraction of the universe, which leaves us at zero any way you slice it. When the mind discovers what it is, we wake up from these mortal dramas as if from a dream. All possible disasters have already happened, and if a future appears, we thread it through the eye of the needle. And whether we act or don't act, voila, miraculously, without exception, things turn out exactly the way they do.
What's risky about this is the way that it approximates the happy sayings that you might find on the refrigerators of simple people, such as my mother, who's not a simple person at all. I guess I have to say that right away, lest someone carry the word back to her. However, she has only a high school education. She has on her refrigerator, Mary, that's how it begins, she had this done up for herself. This is God. I just want to let you know that I'm going to be handling things for the next few days. You don't have to worry about it. Have a nice time. And, you know, this does, but, you know, if there's the risk, Someone pointed out to me once that it's always in trailer camps, you know, cheap apartments that you find the happiest sayings. Smile, it's contagious, or smile, they'll think you're up to something. You know, you never find those in the houses of senior professors, do you?
Not that I know of, and you could do worse than those sayings.
Yes.
You could do better, but you could do worse.
I mean, but this is this fits into the tradition, doesn't it, of looking for wisdom among the humble and among the great. It doesn't coordinate with education, with
no, not at all.
You know, intelligence.
Not at all. And there's a lot to be said for them. And to my mind, ultimately, they don't work. There are lots of systems of positive thinking that try to replace negative or stressful thoughts with happy thoughts or positive thoughts. You know, the Secret, that mega bestseller a couple of years ago, is one of them. And basically, they can work for a while or up to a certain point, but what people are doing is taking a positive thought and suppressing everything that they actually believe, and that's still at deep levels doesn't lose its power, so that it's like plastering over one reality with another. It can help, and it's not a real solution.
It's forced, and everything that you're evoking in this translation of the Tao is unforced. That's the essential element, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, these are words of somebody who's living in what I would call reality, or the way things are, which is one way of translating Tao. It's not somebody who's pretending in any way. It's someone who's entered the reality that lies beyond our thoughts about reality, and who is living a life where there is no problem, literally, a life of continuous peace and happiness. And this is possible for human beings. It's not Pollyannish, it's not theoretical. It really, words like this coming from depths like this have a certain authenticity to them, to my mind. And that's what I find so very attractive about them.
There's something else about the passage that I just read, the selection that I just read, which prompts me to tell the story of how Stephen and I first met. I was working as an editor at Doubleday in New York in the religious publishing division. A man from the special projects division, where they did things like books about drapes and books about finishing your back porch and, you know, self-help project books of that sort, lots of clothing books, sewing books, had somehow happened into the possession of a manuscript translation of the Book of Job. It had been sent him by the famous drama critic Harold Clurman, with whom somehow he had a connection. I think they may have been neighbors in the same building in New York. He didn't know what to do with this, so he asked me if I would take a look at it. And I was a displaced Bible scholar. I had been denied tenure at Loyola University of Chicago for taking too liberal a position on abortion, and had fetched up as an editor in New York. So I knew something about the Book of Job, and I read the first sentence, and I saw that this was a translation in a class by itself. It was really quite exceptional. I also saw the liberties that had been taken, which, by the way, no reviewer ever noticed. A whole large section was left out. Of course, also left out, cunning fellow, this Mitchell. He also left out the chapter and verse numbers, you know. So that simple clue wasn't there, and you had to have some acquaintance with the book first to notice that this had been done. So I sent him a note and said, I think we'd like to publish this, but I'd like to talk to you about it. Could you come to New York and see me? He was not that far away in New Haven, Connecticut. So he came down, and it was a cold, blustery, miserable winter day, slushy, awful. And who should arrive, you know, in my little office but a monk? A monk in a saffron robe with a bare shoulder and all this. And the thing I can never forget is those feet, you know, and these sandals in this cold weather. And a shaven head. And that was my friend over here. I was astonished. But
a previous incarnation.
A previous incarnation. And in due course, the book came out with a wonderful etching on the cover by, what was the?
Leonard Baskin.
Leonard Baskin, yeah. An original Leonard Baskin etching on the cover. But I left Doubleday to go to work at the University of California Press, and that translation was kind of an orphan and didn't get review attention. Later, it appeared in a new edition from North Point Press at a moment when that press, headquartered in the Bay Area, was very smart and chic and got lots of attention. And in the course of my work for the University of California Press, I went up to Berkeley one time, and we met again, and Stephen looked more or less as he looks now.
With hair.
And yes, his hair had grown out, and he had a girl with him. I said, what happened? He said, I gave my vows back to the Buddha. And this turns out to be not a flip remark. It is a step that Buddhist monks can go through. And I wished I'd had some such step available to me when I left the Jesuits. So that's how we met.
The Zen master that I was living with and studying with for many years gave his blessing to it, so it made things very easy. But I also want to mention that first line, here's how the first line that Jack liked went, God damn the day I was born.
Yes, and you know, existing translations were something like, perish the day in which I was born, or may that day perish, in which, you know, words like that, sentences with that kind of structure. The word God does not appear in the original, but God damn, and the expression God damn, isn't really, you know, a reference, a direct, thoughtful reference to the deity. It's an expression of emotion, and it was perfect, you know, for the line. It was exactly right. But in the book of Job, toward the end, there, when Job wants God to answer him, why are you treating me this way? And it's God's silence that torments him most. Finally, God appears as the voice from the whirlwind, and all that voice asks is a series of rhetorical questions. Do you think that it needs your guidance? Don't the heavens turn by themselves? The questions here have a certain distinct resemblance to that rhetorical sequence of questions spoken by the voice from the whirlwind. The voice from the whirlwind has an element of anger in it that's missing here, or not needed here, or not desired here, but there's a connection. Okay, let's go to, here's another sort of daring one in another way. Wait till the last sentence. This is number 57. Another animal connection here, and I'm going to return to this before we run out of time. Once when a seabird landed outside the capital, the Marquis of Lu escorted it to his ancestral temple, had the music of the ninefold splendors performed, poured out a cup of old wine, and spread before it a feast of beef and pork. But the bird became dazed, and it pined away, refusing to taste meat or wine. In 3 days, it was dead. This was treating the bird as the Marquis would have liked to be treated, not as the bird would have liked to be treated. Had he done so, he would have let it roost in the deep forests, play among the islands, swim in the rivers and lakes, feed on mudfish and minnows, fly with the rest of the flock, and live any way it chose to.
Here's the commentary. The capital of Lu must have been seriously landlocked if this seabird An albatross, perhaps, seemed so exotic. The bird was a sensible creature, and the last thing it wanted was celebrity. The Marquis, a famous epicure and an obtusely empathetic fellow, proceeded to kill it with kindness. He chose the best of everything, but the bird was not impressed by the ancient Chinese equivalents of a 1947 Cheval Blanc, a 3-star Michelin meal, and the Goldberg variations. It died pining for its freedom and a couple of fresh fish. The Marquis was not the only person in history who, by acting out the golden rule, became the golden fool. Was he repentant afterward? Did he start buttonholing wedding guests and holding them with his glittering eye? In any case, the extravagance of his selfishness removes him from history and inserts him into parable. Any child can tell you that hay is for horses, milk is for cats, and fish is for albatrosses, and that we should let wild animals live any way they choose to. Love your neighbor as yourself. Leave him alone.
A moment ago, Stephen, you said when I brought up refrigerator magnet wisdom that there's nothing incompatible between the wisdom translated in this book and social activism. Want to say something more about that? Because the closing sentence in its daring seems to say, don't worry about Rwanda, don't worry about Darfur, leave them alone.
Yeah, and that reminds me of the statement from John Cage that you quoted before, a wonderful statement about there's not too much suffering in the world, there's just enough, just the right amount. Here's what I see in that. When you have investigated your own thinking and questioned beliefs that cause a huge amount of stress, from ordinary stress to actually great suffering or despair, concepts such as there's too much suffering in the world, or people shouldn't lie, you can step into what the ancient Chinese would call the Tao, the way things are, the world as it is, not the world as we think it should be, and is and should be become exactly the same thing. Living without the stress of those shoulds and shouldn'ts results in a life of tremendous fulfillment without stress and with a lot more energy. And that energy is available for anything, whether it's staying home and cultivating your garden or going out and being an ecological activist or going to Darfur, etc. It's not that you, once you've understood the truth or once you've embodied the Tao, the way things are, it's not that you sit in a corner and drool. It's that you go out and do what your passions lead you to do, whether that be political activism or playing the violin or teaching kindergarten. That's what I mean.
But isn't there an element of desire in all of those? I mean, you use the word passions. Mm-hmm. And yet this seems to me to be a picture of a kind of passionless quiescence.
Well, that's not my experience. My experience is that without stress, you're free to dive into what you love. I don't see passion as the equivalent of desire. It's not that you desire to change the world. You simply are riding the current of what is and riding the current of your own passion. And then, for instance, you may sit and write a book that pleases you, and it turns out that a lot of people benefit from it and think that it's wonderful, and that was the furthest thing from your mind when you were writing. You were simply doing what you love to do. So there's no goal involved, and that goallessness is a great freedom, and it turns out that it is a great kindness to other people as well, although that's not the intention.
There's a new book out, a kind of protracted conversation with Seamus Heaney, and the person speaking to him asks him about a particular line and has a hunch about why he wrote this line, and it had to do with other poets and it had to do with Ireland at the time. And Heaney quickly said, no, I wasn't thinking about any of that. I was writing it to please myself. There is this about poetry that works, that if the poet isn't in love with the sound of the words that he's producing, it's unlikely that you will be either. I'm sure you know that. I feel that, you know, the way anyone with your level of poetic taste and gifts would. And yet there are times when one can call upon to do something that goes against his nature, goes against all his spontaneous tendencies. Someone may try to enter Darfur despite the fact that the government has expelled all outsiders and is prepared to enforce its decree by killing them if they try to go there. People do go there, go enter such situations anyway. Do you not see any contradiction here?
No contradiction. If that's where your love lies, then you go. The thing is that once you've understood the mind at this level, you've also understood death. There are some wonderful chapters here. I mean, more than wonderful. There are some hair-raising and life-changing chapters here that center on the issue of death. And it becomes, you know, with a clear mind, life and death, as Chuang Tzu says, become trivial matters. There's something that embraces both, and that wouldn't stop somebody at all from going to, for instance, Darfur, because there's no longer that sense of protectiveness about the self. They're simply surfing the current of what is, and that's the only thing that matters.
Let's go to another one about life and death, and that was one I wasn't thinking that we would do, but let's do it. Number 55. Life is the companion of death. Death is the beginning of life. Who can understand how the two are related? But if life and death are companions, why should you be concerned? All things are connected at the root. We arrive here from the unknown and go back to where we came from. What people love about life is its miraculous beauty. What they hate about death is the loss and decay around it. Yet losing is not losing, and decay turns into beauty as beauty turns back into decay. We are breathed in, breathed out. Therefore, all you need is to understand the one breath that makes up the world. The master is always conscious of the mystery at the heart of all things.
And this is the commentary. After the joyful, raucous skepticism of the earlier chapters, a bucket full of ice water poured onto you while you're still snoozing under the comforter, this chapter's mode of unknowing is a grandmotherly kindness. Life becomes very gentle when you understand that you're not living it.
In that case, the commentary was quite a bit shorter than this. My compliments for that.
I like sometimes to throw a bit of a curveball.
Okay, here's one that you know, death comes to us all, and the way that it will come to most of us is in the way described in that last selection, which is to say, by gradual decay and by death of natural causes. But some die violently. Some die in armed conflict. Those are the deaths. Those are the losses that seem to preoccupy us most, aren't they? Here's a selection about that. Number 43. Give up wanting to be important. Let your footsteps leave no trace. No, this is the one. I'm sorry. Give up wanting to be important. Let your footsteps leave no trace. Travel alone as the Tao to the land of the great silence. If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own boat, he won't get offended or angry, however hot-tempered he may be. But if the boat is manned, he may flare up, shouting and cursing, just because there's a rower. Realize that all boats are empty as you cross the river of the world, and nothing can possibly offend you.
Commentary. When you understand how utterly alone you are, it's a cause for celebration. Break out the caviar and champagne. Le roi est mort, vive le roi. If everyone is your projection in the first place, if you see not them, but who you think they are, how can you be offended? Scene, a river. You're drifting along in your little boat, happy as a minnow, and suddenly some jerk bangs into you full force. But when you look, it's an empty boat. Since there's no offender, naturally there's no offense. Someone might say, you mean that the woman who broke my heart, or my backstabbing colleague, or the politicians who got us into this mess, they're all empty boats? Yes, indeed. This has nothing to do with taking the right action against greed or stupidity. But if you're offended, it means that you're not paying attention.
Years ago, as an editor at the University of California Press, I published a co-authored book by the late Aaron Woldowski and the anthropologist Mary Douglas. It was called Risk and Danger. And one of the topics they discussed was the intellectual breakthrough of the natural disaster. In many primitive tribes, there is no such notion. All disasters are understood to be caused, and the cause is always someone in the community, and the response to the disaster is to take it out on the responsible individual. This distinction has its analog in our own day, they said, even in our own state, and that it is was much easier at that time to rally people to demonstrate against a nuclear power plant than it was to rally people against a much more proximate and certain danger, namely earthquake. Why? Because we seem to have a natural proclivity to respond to enemy people rather than to inanimate danger. The idea in this passage seems to me to be that it is possible to regard all disasters, even those that are inflicted upon you as a neighbor, by an enemy rather, as natural disasters, mm-hmm. and maintain the same relative equanimity that we manage to maintain.
Well, you know, this is a perception that comes from some of the great texts, not only in Taoism and Buddhism, but Hinduism also, like the great lines from the Bhagavad Gita about you're not doing it, you're being done. And that's an incredibly freeing perception of reality, in my experience.
We're going to go to questions and comments in just a moment, but there is one selection here that particularly struck me, and I decided in advance that I would close with it. There was a beginning of time. There was a time before the beginning of time. There was a time before the beginning of time. There is being. If there is being, there must be non-being. If there is non-being, there must have been a time when even non-being didn't exist. Suddenly, there was non-being. But can non-being really exist? And can being not exist? I just said something. But did what I just said really say anything or not?
He's very tricky, isn't he? Commentary. The mind loves to play its little games about time. It visualizes time as space. It fills in the blanks. It sees a before and an after. It befores the before, afters the after. Before is the after, after is the before, and that's just the beginning. By the time it has finished articulating futures and pasts, It is bound up in its own complications, a ball of perplexity waiting for the coup de grâce. How thorough Shuangzi is in deconstructing himself. He delights in being hoist with his own petard. He's like the cartoon character sitting out on a limb backward and sawing it away, except that he knows perfectly well what will happen. His questions are more than Socratic. They cut to the bone. Here's the open secret. There is no beginning of time, only a beginning of thought. It arises from the I. That's the capital I. It arises from the I, the subtlest thought of all, which splits reality down the middle, creating this and that, inner and outer, and all the other mirrored zeros and ones that make up this apparent universe. Then suddenly, one fine day, mind realizes that it knows nothing, that it is nothing, and sets itself free. Being? Non-being? Give me a break.
When I read this passage, what I thought of was a book about the evolution of the human species called Before the Dawn by Nicholas Wade, the science editor of the New York Times. In the course of talking about the evolution of the human species, Wade has occasion to summarize for his readers the results of recent work on the origin of language. Language, as we encounter it in school, is grammar and vocabulary, semantics and syntax, right? Animals have vocabulary. Animals have semantics. There are a range of calls that for a chimpanzee or even many species of birds have meanings. There is correlation. What no species but the human species has is syntax, the ability to take a large but still finite body of such correlations and combine them and recombine them in an infinite number, always proceeding by means of a set of binary oppositions, now and then, alive, dead, here, there, yes, no, self, other, present, absent, and so on. Because this is a part of the human makeup, because it is a part of our human specificity, we really can never escape it entirely. And yet, we carry within us everything that preceded it, as well as everything that that followed it. I mean, we are descendants of hominids who lived without all that. So if we can't escape it entirely, we can, it seems to me, I find this a suggestive thought, we can at least remember it and teach ourselves to return to the state, I can't exactly say of mind, but perhaps I can, the state of mind, the state of being that our forebears lived with and lived in. There is the air about these ancient texts that we date them to the 6th century BCE, but that's just kind of a matter of historical convenience. They seem much older than that. And perhaps there is this deep memory, a kind of animal memory. Personally, I can't imagine myself entering that state, or have entered it perhaps in meditation, or am drawn to it, seduced toward it by some of the brilliant verses in this book. I can't imagine living in it all the time.
Well, I not only can, but it's a reality. And one of the things that I love about the use of language here is that these chapters are using the binary language that is part of human language to undo the binary language, so that it's using language to undermine itself, and it's a constant experience when you're reading it carefully, not, and even not so carefully, of feeling anytime that you're ready to grasp a particular truth, that in the next sentence, the opposite truth comes along and explodes that truth that you think you've just grasped. Or, you know, three times within three sentences or two sentences, or you'll feel the rug pulled out from under you and there's nothing to stand on. And that's a wonderful introduction into what my old Zen master used to call don't know mind, the mind that is free of its own ideas and that is completely open to the way things actually are.
Well, on that note, let's turn to some comments and questions from you. Begin wherever you would like to begin. Yes, sir, in the back. There is a mic. There are two microphones or just one tonight?
We didn't hear any selections from Confucius' grandson. Could you read perhaps one of those?
Sure. They're also wonderful. Let's see. I'll just read the chapter, not the commentary. This is number two. Before sorrow, anger, longing, or fear have arisen, you are in the center. When these emotions appear and you know how to see through them, you are in harmony. That center is the root of the universe. That harmony is the Tao which reaches out to all things. Once you find the center and achieve harmony, heaven and earth take their proper places, and all things are fully nourished. There's a slightly different tone to it. He doesn't have the kind of outrageous belly laugh humor that Shuang Tzu does, but I feel that they fit perfectly together. And people who have started to read this don't really know which is which until they go to the notes section. So it's a wonderful mellow.
What's the
proportion?
Is it?
They're out of 64 chapters. I think I found 12 from Tzu Tzu and 52 from Shuang Tzu.
Front row here. Wait till you get the microphone.
So if there's just enough suffering, then how does that relate to the Buddha's wish to end the suffering of all sentient beings?
That's a very good question. The best thing that the Buddha did, in my opinion, was to end the suffering of one sentient being, himself. And that's not an easy thing. If you're concerned about the suffering of the human race, and a lot of people think of compassion as a mode of suffering, if your focus is on that, then it's never going to happen, because the one who's seeing the world is never going to end his suffering. The proper order of things is first you end your own suffering, and then it's possible to end the suffering of all sentient beings. In fact, it turns out that they're exactly equivalent. When you have found that ultimate inner peace, you cannot project anything onto the world that is suffering. And that might sound like an extremely selfish, uncaring way of going about your life, but in fact, it's something that creates a great radiance that people are attracted to and that people can learn from that example of the end of suffering. And that's the only possible end of suffering that there can be. That's what the Buddha did.
I want to thank you both so much for coming. One of my all-time favorite books, besides Gotabiography, is Meetings with the Archangel. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to write that?
This is a work of fiction that I subtitled A Comedy of the Spirit. I think it was in 1995. I had just moved to Sonoma. I had an image of the Archangel Gabriel coming to a person who, in a lot of ways, was like me outside this little barn that I had in Sonoma, California. And it filled me with delight because it was a very interesting beginning for what became a story. And that beginning involved a Zen student someone who had been practicing intensive Zen meditation for quite some while, who when he had that experience with the Archangel Gabriel, felt that he was a failure as a Zen student, because visions of that sort, as I was instructed early on in my career by my Zen master, are very much short of the experience of understanding. You can have spectacular, transcendent, mystical experiences, and that's very far from it. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to investigate this, and in the process, investigate what might be possible in the angelic realms once you get beyond conventional Christian ideas. So in my Archangel Gabriel, for instance, when he's describing to my hero what it's like in heaven, talks about angelic sex. This was wonderfully interesting for me. It's an idea that I found in Blake, who has a wonderful passage about angels commingling in the act of sexual joy, and how heaven is very far from the puritanical experience of floating around in nightgowns and playing harps and having little flappy white wings. So that's where it started, and it led to all sorts of interesting places for me, and I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Reminded of Augustine's view of he thought there was sex in heaven too. In heaven, a man would have an erection whenever he wanted one, and never when he didn't.
That was before Viagra too. I always love it in these ads where they say, if your erection lasts more than 4 hours, please call a doctor. Sage advice.
Or a nurse.
I think that's the last person you'd want to call.
I also loved your commentary on Genesis, which I think is only an audio tape. I don't know if you wrote it, but I had a great time listening to that years ago. My question is that earlier you said that Confucianism and Taoism were overlapping, and I wasn't sure if you meant in chronology or in philosophy, but if it was in philosophy, it seems to me that Confucius's grandson in this writing really was a Taoist, because I didn't see any of the pietal obligation in the writing. Although, actually, we really didn't listen to him except for that one quote. But could you speak to that a bit?
Well, that's a historical question, and in the green room beforehand, Stephen said, if historical questions come up, I will decline to take them. So I'll take a stab at that. Confucianism and Taoism are, of course, Western coinages. And the word Tao can apply to what we call Confucianism as well as to what we call Taoism in Chinese. The word Tao can also apply to Christianity. There's the editor that, of a Chinese religion in the Norton Anthology, and I had a Skype conversation once while he was in the waiting room of his doctor's office, and he mentioned to me that the title of the Christian magazine on the doctor's table was Dao. So it's a term of general applicability. As to the more specific content and how it originated, both traditions were very ritualistic with a lot of magical elements, what we would call magical elements at the start. The thought that you got magic only on one side or only on the other side has been put aside by historians of Chinese religion now. In time, there was a perceived separation, and once you have a perceived separation, then you tend to have an enforced separation and separate later evolution. So the further back you go, the more you find everything mingled. The further down you come, the more they're separate.
Yeah, I would just want to make a comment. The way you appear on the stage is really a carry out of yourself in terms of Taoism, because I can tell you just came in without any motion of your self-centered motion. I read a book, New Earth, by Eckhart Tolle. Could you make a comment about that book, please?
Have you read it?
What is it?
A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, Eckhart Tolle. No, I haven't read it. I'm sorry.
I haven't read it either, but he's a friend of mine, and actually a friend of mine through my wife. I don't know, some of you may have read some books by Byron Katie, my wife, and if you haven't, I highly recommend them. There's actually... I've written them with her, and the third of her books is called A Thousand Names for Joy, and that's a commentary on the Tao Te Ching, which gave birth actually to this new book. And it's not only I would say one of the most profound books that I know of, but it's a portrait of the mind completely at one with the way things are. So it's something you might want to take a look at. As for Eckhart Tolle, I haven't read the book, but I do know that he has an audience of millions of people who are finding clarity and hope through his writing. So I think that's a wonderful thing for the world.
Did you care to say something about him that... About Tolle, or Tolle?
I read Zhuangzi myself, and I grasped all the intelligence pretty well, and it's hard to carry out in daily life because it's very abstract unless you go to the action yourself like you did. You go through the Buddhas and the whole life searching for it. And for me, A New Earth seems a way of doing things. Show me a way of doing things in really a positive, a method, rather than, because Zhuangzi is a philosophy. It's really hard to carry out. That's what I mean. I don't know how do you...
How do you carry it out?
Yes.
The practice... Practices, disciplines, that's a topic I'd like to hear you talk about.
Yeah, well, personally for me, as I mentioned, you know, it was a question of quite many years of quite grueling meditation practice, which included things like 100-day solitary retreats with the practice being 20 hours a day of meditation. I wouldn't recommend it, but... But I was very hungry for insight at the time. The wonderful thing about Byron Katie's method of self-inquiry, which you'll find in a book called Loving What is that it's extremely simple. And it's a way of not only as Eckhart Tolle says, of becoming the space around thoughts, but of actually questioning the stressful thoughts that are the cause of all suffering in the world. And as you question them, seeing those thoughts unravel by themselves. People are always in spiritual realms saying, let go of your suffering, let go of your negative thoughts. And it's not possible because you didn't create them in the first place. But what is possible is to question them, and as you gain insight that way, to see them unravel, and then, as Katie says, the thoughts let go of you. So if you're interested in seeing how to actually live this way, then I would highly recommend Loving What Is as a simple and extremely powerful method of entry into the Tao.
Okay, two more questions. There's a question in the front here, Libby.
Thank you for a wonderful evening, the both of you. As you speak about Eckhart Tolle, when I read Eckhart Tolle, and I really enjoy his writings, and I always think of Krishnamurti, and I think it's almost like a reiteration of what I've heard Krishnamurti say in the Ojai Meadows over the years from the 60s, and I wonder if you too were ever in his audience in Ojai.
I happen to live in Ojai, but not back then. So the answer is no, and I never actually even read his books back then. My entry was from a different direction, but I know he's been important to a lot of people.
I almost see a parallel, like a reincarnation, in terms of the writing.
We have time for one last question. There's a question over there. Let me.
Thank you. This is totally different, but I'm a big fan of your translations of Rilke, and I'm wondering what drew you to Rilke and how that fits in with the Tao or the other spiritual things that you're talking about.
I was given a little book by Rilke called Letters to a Young Poet when I was 20 years old and living in Paris, actually, and it was in a French version. And when I first read that book, I felt like the top of my head had been taken off. Many people have had this same kind of experience and felt that this was my teacher speaking to me at a depth that I had never heard before of everything important at that time, and not only at that time, love, beauty,
integrity,
creativity, and solitude. And speaking of solitude as something full of possibilities, not as a disease, which I thought it was at the time. And so when I got back to America from Paris, I learned German so that I could get as close as possible to his poetry. And just as I later learned Hebrew to get close to the Book of Job, because I had fallen in love with that consciousness, I don't think there's a greater poet than Rilke, certainly in the 20th century. The great Russian poet Marina Tsvetaeva, in a letter to Rilke, said, "I don't think that you're only a great poet. I think that you are poetry." And a lot of people, especially in reading his late great masterpieces, the Duino Elegies and the Sonnets to Orpheus, have that experience of something essential being touched, of the depths of human passion and human longing and suffering and fulfillment being embodied in the most gorgeous music possible in human language. So that's my experience too. And there's also a level of clarity that comes through in these great poems where I feel that not only is a beauty being transmitted through the words, but truth. And it's very rare for me that great poets can match the beauty of their language with the accuracy of their insight. The way Auden said of Yeats, you know, you were silly like us. A lot of Yeats is this gorgeous silliness. But Rilke had, to my mind, a connection with the essential. Not that he lived it. He lived a very messy life, to say the least, a life of great suffering. But he had access to it at moments of huge inspiration. And that was where he was able to connect with himself and to connect with all of us.
Trying to recall the name of the German philosopher Scheler, I think, who was asked about the disparity between his great thought and his messy life, and he said, "The thing about a signpost is that it never moves down the road." I'm happy that we've ended on this point of poetry. The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss said that myth was that which didn't require linguistic perfection in order to cross from one culture, from one language to another. There's something true about that observation. But it's also true that poetry is that which is lost in translation, and that poetry was a part of the power always, or even the beauty of prose, when prose is the form employed in the great spiritual classics. So if they can be delivered to us with some of the power that's proper to our language, they always reach us, I think, more powerfully. So that's our gratitude to you, Stephen. Thank you for the conversation.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.